The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that is GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated March 14/March 21, 2022. The cover, as usual, is bordered in red with a narrow inner white border. Large block letters, capitals, spell Time on the front page, the front cover. It's in a gray tone today, and the printing on the cover is in something other than English because I'm unable to read it. Perhaps it's in Russian, or perhaps it's in another Eastern European hand script. But below it in English is printed Volodymyr Zelensky and the Heroes of Ukraine by Simon Schuster. Vertically, the top of the graphic on the cover is in blue, fading into yellow on the bottom. I'm looking for a credit for that graphic, and I'm not seeing it. So anyway, it is Time's cover, primarily in blue on the top and yellow on the bottom. Beginning then with For the Record, the short bits of information here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, comprise this page, 8 short items, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Today's ruling is frustrating for those who are hoping for some real change, by Clement Tan. Spokesperson for the Singaporean LGBTQ rights group, Pink.sg. In a February 28 statement, shortly after the country's top court declined to overturn a law criminalizing gay sex. 2,000 euros, the bonus offered by the Italian region of Lazio as part of a campaign to boost wedding tourism. From February 28, couples who wed in Lazio this year can submit receipts to receive up to that limit, roughly $2,200, in refunds. I very much desire to be divorced, spoken by Kim Kardashian. In February 23, legal documents seeking to end her marriage to Kanye West, whom she described as causing her emotional distress, March 2. A Los Angeles judge declared Kardashian legally single. $4.4 million. The number of objects, mainly galaxies and black holes, shown in a new image created by the space telescope LOFAR, including about a million that have never been seen before, per a February 25 announcement. This could possibly be a last recall of memories that we have experienced in life, from Dr. Ajmal Zemar, neurosurgeon at the University of Louisville, in an interview with the BBC about his study, published February 22, showing brain activity similar to dreaming in the last seconds of a person's life. 10. The new maximum length in minutes for TikTok videos, the social media platform announced February 28, a marked increase from the previous 3-minute limit. There is no ending for what I carry in my heart, said Sabrina Fulton in remarks February 26, 10th anniversary of the death of her son Trayvon Martin, whose killer's acquittal inspired the Black Lives Matter movement. Capitalism without competition is not capitalism. Capitalism without competition is exploitation, from Joe Biden, President of the United States, in his March 1 State of the Union Address. The brief news, a deadly deluge is the caption here of a flooded area. Lots of buildings are not underwater, but they are affected by a huge element of standing water beside many of the buildings. It looks like a lake, but I'm guessing it is part of a suburb. The caption reads, "Floodwaters strand vehicles along a street in Gympie or Gympie, G-Y-M-P-I-E, a city in southeastern Queensland, Australia, February 27. Brisbane, Queensland's capital, recorded 24.1 inches of rain from February 25 to February 27, an all-time record, according to AccuWeather. Rising water levels have since forced over 15,000 people to evacuate, threatened up to 18,000 homes across the state, and killed at least 8 people, according to the Associated Press. Tara Law is credited with that photo and caption. The bulletin, "The window to adapt to climate change is rapidly closing," warns the UN climate science body. This short article by Kyla Mandel and Justin Warland. It is unequivocal that climate change has already disrupted human and natural systems, states the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, in a February 28 report warning humans must accelerate efforts to adapt communities in preparation for the challenges of a warming world. Any further delay in concerted anticipatory global action, the report says, will miss a brief and rapidly closing window of opportunity to secure a livable and sustainable future for all. Hot topics. The next decade will prove a crucial test of whether the world can move fast enough to address an increasingly complex challenge. There was concern among many in the climate community that highlighting the acute need for investment in adaptation would undermine the importance of reducing emissions, says Nat Kiohane, president of the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions. This report should put that debate to rest for good. Many communities are running up against their limits. We are already finding that while some people and places are adapting, they're being pushed beyond their abilities, says Adele Thomas, a climate analytics researcher and one of the IPCC report's authors. Among the most vulnerable are low-lying coastal communities and smallholder farmers. More financing is needed, the report says, to tackle the growing gap between those who can afford adaptation projects and those who cannot. The science could not be more clear, says Tina Steg, the Marshall Islands climate envoy. Failing to adapt to this crisis will cost lives. Failing to provide fair, accessible climate finance will cost lives. Continued dependence on fossil fuels will cost lives. With the consequences of inaction spelled out so clearly, a failure to act is inhuman and unconscionable. More brief news from the news ticker. 3 short articles in this climate. CDC lifts mask rules for most of U.S. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced February 25 it no longer advises mask wearing in public indoor spaces for most Americans, citing its new methodologies for determining community risk. Masks are still required on airplanes and trains and in transit centers, however, through March 18. Guilty verdicts in Floyd officers' trial. 3 former Minneapolis Police Department officers, Tu Tao, J. Alexander Kung, and Thomas Lane, who were with Derek Chauvin when he killed George Floyd, were found guilty February 24 of federal charges of violating Floyd's civil rights and could face decades in prison. The officers also still face charges in state court. NC police break up anti-vax protest. March 2, police removed protesters from grounds outside New Zealand's parliament that they had occupied for over 3 weeks in opposition to the country's vaccine mandate. Protesters set fire to tents and mattresses as they retreated. Some threw objects at the officers. The brief news, good question. Why isn't inflation ending? By Alana Samuels. The cost of goods keeps rising, 6.1% last year, according to government numbers released February 25, and lots of ink has been spilled, debating why. But the simplest explanation may be this: because of long-term demographic shifts, the U.S., like many other countries, simply does not have enough workers to make and move all the things that people want to buy. And companies have to raise wages and thus prices to attract available workers. There are 11 million job openings in the U.S. economy right now, yet there are only 6.5 million people who are unemployed. All of our gaps in the supply chain are because people are not there to make the goods, says Ron Hetrick, senior economist at Burning Glass, a labor market data and analytics company that put out a report February 22, The Demographic Drought, Bridging the Gap in Our Labor Force. States like Maine, New Hampshire, West Virginia are already super-aged, meaning 20% of the population is 65 or older. The entire U.S. will be super-aged by 2028, estimates Olu Sonola, head of regional economics at Fitch Ratings. Economists thought that boomers born between 1946 and 1964 would stay in the labor market for longer. But boomers' homes have gotten more valuable, and their stock market portfolios have grown over the last few years. So when the pandemic hit, they decided to retire. More than half of the 5 million people who dropped out of the labor force since early 2020 are 55 or older, Hetrick calculates. U.S. Census data suggests early retirements account for 3.4 million people. The average expected likelihood of working beyond age 62 declined to a new low of 49.3% in November, according to a survey from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The worrying part of demographic-driven inflation is that it is not going away anytime soon. Last year, the U.S. population grew at 0.1%, its slowest rate since the nation's founding, according to the census, and the fertility rate continues to decline. By 2034, older adults will outnumber children for the first time in U.S. history. Immigrants can fill that gap, but they are fewer now, too. Falling immigration had already started happening, but it was worsened by COVID, says Hetrick. New international migration in 2021 was at its lowest level in at least a decade. Meanwhile, U.S. consumers are spending as if nothing's changed, keeping demand for goods and services high. The most obvious effect of this demographic shift is in their pocketbooks. Every economist I've heard who says inflation is going to last this long or that long, I say, do you have a crystal ball that tells you exactly when these people are going to come back to the workforce? Hetrick says, if we do not get the boomers back and immigration does not improve, I'm just telling you the math. I'm not sure how we get back to growth. More from the news ticker. Three more short items. Nepal protests erupt over U.S. aid grant. Nepal's parliament approved a contentious $500 million U.S. grant February 27, despite opposition from protesters and coalition parties. Opponents claim the deal, signed in 2017 to fund infrastructure projects, is part of an Indo-Pacific military strategy by the U.S. and could undermine Nepali sovereignty. Antarctic sea ice at record low. Sea ice cover around Antarctica reached a four-decade low February 22 of 750,000 square miles, breaking a slight average upward trend observed since the 1970s. Scientists cannot definitively link the drop to climate change, but they say a complex set of factors, including strong winds and increased sea surface temperatures, may be to blame. MLB union dispute delays start of season. March 1, Major League Baseball canceled the first two series of its 2022 season, which was set to begin March 31, after the league and the players' union failed to agree on a new collective bargaining agreement by a management-imposed deadline. The risk report by Ion Bremmer, how Putin's mistake has united the world against him. What would it take to persuade the EU to ship weapons into a war zone for the first time in its history? To get Germany to sharply increase its military spending? To inspire famously neutral Switzerland to announce sanctions against the home of some of its biggest banking customers? To push Finland and Sweden to entertain NATO membership? To have Turkey block warships from passing from the Black Sea into the Mediterranean, to move Europeans to sanction the country that supplies 40% of their natural gas, to support severing the access of a military superpower's banks to the global financial system. Before Vladimir Putin ordered a large-scale invasion of Ukraine, none of these developments was plausible. But as Russian soldiers continue their onslaught on Ukraine's largest cities, all these things have either happened or are under serious consideration. Before this war began, world leaders could still debate whether NATO had a purpose and transatlantic ties had a future. America's pivot to Asia now falls somewhere between last week's news and painful punchline. Russia's president now has the U.S., British, French, and German governments marching in lockstep. He has drilled deep into the earth to uncover one of the very few issues that have Democrats and Republicans patting each other on the back. Will this unity last? On this issue, yes. Having pushed this far down the road to Kyiv, Putin cannot back down and lose face. Russia's government has the weapons and the will needed to intensify a conflict that will kill thousands of Ukrainians and Russians. Before the guns fall silent, millions will be forced from their homes. Putin has demonstrated the Europe-Russia relationship can never return to the cynical pragmatism of the past two decades, so long as he remains in the Kremlin. Ukraine's government will almost certainly be forced into exile, but Europe and the U.S. will actively support resistance, perhaps even an insurgency. European leaders will probably slow play Ukraine's new bid for membership in the EU, but they will not explicitly refuse it. Russia will keep the pariah status that Putin's brought it. Threats from Moscow to target the Baltic states or stir trouble in the Balkans will further stiffen U.S. and European spines. And if Putin responds to sanctions and other international pressure by lashing out, in cyberspace or with more traditional weapons, Western resistance to his rule will only intensify. The result of all this is a permanent breach between Putin's Russia and the West, one that cannot be mended. The Russian president's historic miscalculation and the West's forceful and well-coordinated response will leave Putin convinced every new step taken to pressure his soldiers out of Ukraine represents a threat to his political survival. That is especially true as the value of Russia's currency plummets and its largest banks teeter. That is why, although Russia's move to place its nuclear forces on high alert does not move us to the brink of World War III, neither is it a threat that other governments can afford to ignore. It is easy to say Putin will not start a nuclear war with NATO, just as it was easy 2 weeks ago to say Putin is not reckless and foolish enough to launch an all-out invasion of Ukraine. History, Earl Caldwell's impact on First Amendment rights. This is by Josiah Bates. It was the fall of 1968. Earl Caldwell had just gotten back to the New York Times offices from a reporting trip. As he recalls, he was at his desk for no more than 5 minutes when a receptionist told him two men were at the office and wanted to speak with him. They were with the FBI. The agents wanted information about a story Caldwell had reported on the Black Panthers and their weaponry. I knew this was the beginning of something real, Caldwell tells Time. A year and a half later, he received a subpoena to appear before a federal grand jury and testify to his knowledge of the Panthers, including his confidential sources. Caldwell had no intention of giving up his sources. It goes against everything you stand for in journalism, he says. He refused to appear before the grand jury. His lawyer argued the First Amendment protects the reporting process. The case eventually made its way to the Supreme Court in February 1972 and was argued in combination with two other cases where journalists had refused to identify sources to law enforcement. In a 5-4 decision, the court ruled against the reporters. Caldwell's determination to stay true to his ethics as a reporter is particularly relevant in the context of the racial reckoning the U.S. has had in recent years. These are black people arguing for black rights. It is just like Martin Luther King Jr., Caldwell said in a 2006 interview. I cannot separate myself from that because I am black and he is talking about my rights. I am a reporter. But reporters are human beings. The View Inbox, Climate is Everything, by Justin Warland, senior correspondent. For years now, there's been a constant stream of stories about a crisis at the border between the U.S. and Mexico as migrants travel north from Central America. On a recent trip to San Diego, I learned about another crisis at the southern border that is threatening lives in local communities and, less directly, around the world. Hours-long waits to enter the U.S. This may sound like a minor pain, but the time it takes vehicles to enter the country means thousands of idling cars and trucks. These vehicles generate considerable air pollution, leading to high levels of particulate matter, a pollutant made of tiny bits of dust, dirt, and smoke. This pollution harms the health of residents who are overwhelmingly Latino and contributes to climate change. Border delays result in 457 metric tons of CO2 emissions daily, as much as 100 passenger vehicles produce in a whole year, per San Diego's Regional Planning Agency. The higher the wait times, the higher the air pollution, says Alejandro Amador of Casa Familiar, a local nonprofit. To address the wait, officials are exploring a range of levers, from expanded bike access to better lane management. During my time in the area, I visited one such lever, the building of a new port of entry that would alleviate congestion. The project coordinator zipped me around the 100-acre construction site, driving up close to the border fence. For years, I've been writing about how climate change seeps into every aspect of our lives. I was still surprised to find a climate story in such an unexpected place. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. If the Republican Party has an id, it might look like Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. Mask requirements? Scrap them. Vaccine mandates? In the trash. Distance learning? Nah, thanks. Throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, Reynolds was among the loudest critics of any efforts to modify personal behavior to curb the spread of the virus. It made her something of a celebrity among conservatives who saw government outreach in every effort to slow the spread of coronavirus. The posture fit perfectly with her political identity, honed over decades in Iowa, climbing from county treasurer to become the first woman elected governor of the state, despite a good old boy's ethos in Des Moines. And that was why, March 1, she delivered the Republicans' official response to President Joe Biden's first State of the Union speech. As an acolyte of Trump's style of politics, she made the restrictions, especially the requirements that students wear masks, the central evidence in a case against Democrats. Republican governors faced the same COVID-19 virus head-on, but we honored your freedoms and saw right away lockdowns and school closures. They came with their own significant costs, she said. In many ways, Reynolds is Sarah Palin 2.0, an avatar to the contemporary conservative movement that rewards shredding norms as meritorious. A star of the Trump era, Reynolds shrugged off stay-at-home orders and signed a law requiring 100% in-person school. She did not mandate masks until late in 2020, after she attended a mask-thin rally with Trump during his bid for re-election. Reynolds' response was a test run of the Republican Party's message heading into November's elections. Judging from her selection and tone, the GOP is betting a Trumpian defiance could deliver majorities in the House and Senate if paired with believable pluck. COVID-19 consumed my dad as a doctor. Then it took his father. By Tara Law, health and science reporter. In early February, I got the call I'd been dreading for months. My 82-year-old father, Charlie Law, L-A-W, had died. I had tried to prepare myself. Grandpa had Parkinson's disease and dementia, and he had been in physical and mental decline for about 4 years. Still, I had not seen him in person for 2 of those years because of the pandemic. Once the initial shock and sadness had washed over me, I was surprised to find I was angry. Losing my grandfather was inevitable, but it felt as if the disease that finally took his life, COVID-19, was not. Although my grandfather was vaccinated and boosted, his dementia had confined him to a nursing home, so he was at the mercy of others to protect him from the virus. While I had accepted my grandpa did not have long to live, and I knew that he was suffering, I'd hoped he'd slip away in his sleep. COVID-19 had robbed him of even that. Shortly after Grandpa passed, I asked my dad, Dr. Kevin Law, a doctor specializing in pulmonology and critical care at Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital, Hamilton, in New Jersey, how he's coping with losing his father to COVID-19. He has helped lead his hospital's response to the pandemic and has treated about 1,200 patients with the disease. At this transcript of our conversation shows, the pandemic changed the way we both experienced the loss of a family member so loved. Grandpa's getting COVID-19 and suffering was the thing I was hoping would not happen. I had an educated guess he was going to get a life-threatening infection this winter, either a urinary tract infection, pneumonia, or COVID. Unfortunately, this latest iteration of COVID is very infectious. If you're susceptible, I don't think there's any escaping it, whether you're out in public or in an institution. Has being on the front lines of the pandemic made it harder for you to cope with Grandpa's decline? I do not think I was as present for my parents as I would have been ordinarily, and that was frustrating. I'm very busy. They're in another part of the country, and at times it's been risky to travel. I was surprised you worked on the day Grandpa passed. It must have been hard for you. For your own mental health, you have to learn how to separate work, play, and personal life. I compartmentalize. You have to be able to do your job. You learn over time, as hard as it is sometimes, to not let it interfere with your professional functioning. If I did, it would be very difficult to function. A lot of people said I should have taken the day off or the week off. I certainly contemplated that, but it would have just been way too much for the people I work with. They would have been overwhelmed. Now, it is not specific here, but it seems to me that Tara Law, the author of this article, is interviewing her father. I expected Grandpa would pass away, but it just feels bad that people did not try harder to stop the virus from spreading. Over time, I have learned not to waste a lot of energy on people's behavior that I cannot change. I try to work on it with individuals, and I do get frustrated at times, dealing with individuals that do not have a good explanation for why they are not getting vaccinated. The fact that some people are going to be resistant to it is just human nature, and there is nothing I can do to change that. I do see people who, even though they are not doing well, are still happy with their decision not to get vaccinated, which is a remarkable thing to me, or they are willing to accept their fate, such as it is. How do you deal with your anger at people for not getting vaccinated? Anger is a strong word. It is more frustration and the feeling of impotence over the situation. There are times when I have empathy fatigue, when I do not feel as empathetic as I would normally feel for a sick, infected patient if they're not vaccinated. I have plenty of empathy for people who did get vaccinated but got sick in spite of it. Maybe my experience helps me to handle the pain of my dad's death a little better, and it helps minimize my anger and frustration. I think that some of the anger that people have about the virus and the restrictions that have been placed on them are somehow transferred onto physicians, nursing staff, hospital workers. When I feel like somebody's targeting me or displacing their anger, this is something that I can call upon to kind of diffuse the situation. I say, "Listen, I lost my dad to this as well. So on some level, I understand what you are feeling." There's a small color photograph embedded in this article. It's Charlie, Kevin, and Beverly Law surround reporter Tara Law in 1992. Those would be the author, Tara Law's parents and grandpa. And Tara Law is an infant on her dad's lap. This item is entitled "The Freedom Fighter." In the face of a brutal Russian invasion, Volodymyr Zelensky has inspired Ukraine and galvanized democracies around the world, by Simon Schuster. There's a photograph here. It's two pages. It's a double spread photo of Volodymyr Zelensky, Zelensky, sitting on the very beautifully carpeted steps, which are marble, between two large marble columns with lots of marble behind him. It says Zelensky in Kyiv, March 1, photographed by Umit Bektas. Ukrainian flags flank him as he is seated in khakis, a khaki t-shirt, khaki trousers. There are sandbags heaped in stacks behind him. The president wanted to get to the trenches. He had already walked for half an hour in his helmet through the mud, surrounded by generals and guards, and he insisted they continue. On the far side of some sagging power lines, the group could see the start of the Russian positions, well within reach of the snipers who killed three Ukrainian soldiers 2 weeks before. But Volodymyr Zelensky refused to stop. "Our guys are over there, right?" the commander-in-chief asked one of his generals who was advising the group to turn back. They'll hear, I came all this way and did not come to see them. They'll be upset. Then Zelensky tossed a glance in my direction, spun around, and continued hiking through the brush. The gesture made me wonder, was this an act? We had met for interviews before, the first time backstage at Zelensky's comedy show in the spring of 2019 during his moonshot campaign for Ukraine's presidency. We met again that winter in Kyiv's presidential headquarters, which he described at the time, only half joking, as a gilded fortress he wanted to escape. But this trip to the front lines last April was the first time I had seen him with his troops. The former actor, playing the part of the Generalissimo, it was not entirely convincing. The danger, though, was very real. By the time Zelensky came to power, Ukraine had been at war with Russia for more than 5 years. The death toll had topped 13,000, with almost nightly shooting or shelling across the front lines, a jagged tear between the once fraternal nations. No one knew at the time the war would soon become incalculably worse. But during our trip to the front, Zelensky was aware the Russian troops were already massing by the tens of thousands on the other side of the border. They want us to be afraid, he told me at the end of the trip as we flew back to Kyiv on the presidential plane. They want the West to be frightened of the strength and power of Russia. There's no big secret here. Zelensky understood showing his fear would play into Russia's hands, though he admitted the threat of an invasion scared him. What is frightening is that their intentions may not end with a show of force at the border, he told me. There could be a broader military plan. About 10 months later, in the early morning hours of February 24, Russia put that plan into effect. Vladimir Putin ordered his troops to denazify Ukraine, his chosen term for ousting the first Jewish president in its history and installing a regime loyal to Russia in his place. The invasion thrust Zelensky into a different role, one that at first seemed ill-suited to his character. His friends and advisors have often told me Zelensky has thin skin. He suffers from the actor's malady, an abiding need to be liked and applauded. We try not to let him look at Facebook, one advisor told me, because critical comments from strangers were liable to depress him. But as the Russian bombs began to fall on Ukrainian cities and troops moved to surround the capital, the president underwent a transformation. Before our eyes, he came to embody a struggle that most Western statesmen had long forgotten how to fight, the one that sometimes required to keep tyranny from killing off democracy. Zelensky not only rallied his own people to defend their nation, inspiring them to toss petrol bombs at Russian military vehicles and stand in the way of tanks. He also galvanized the world's democracies in ways that seemed unthinkable just a week before. The change was not instantaneous. Western leaders were still divided 2 days after the invasion when they met to agree on a package of sanctions to punish Russia for its attack. Germany, Hungary, and Italy initially wanted to water down these measures. Then Zelensky dialed into their meeting, calm but determined, his pale face covered in stubble. He told the leaders of the free world this might be the last time they'd see him alive. The enemy has marked me as target number one, he said in a video statement shortly after the call. My family is target number two. Yet Zelensky decided to stay in his capital, an act of courage that's already altered the course of history. It roused the U.S. and its allies to impose unprecedented penalties against Russia, crashing the ruble and unplugging much of its economy from the rest of the world. Germany decided to pour more than $100 billion into its military, casting aside a post-war tradition of pacifism that has long frustrated allies. Switzerland broke from its tradition of neutrality to support sanctions. The EU agreed to put Ukraine on a path to membership, shedding decades of internal resistance. On the sixth day of the invasion, Zelensky delivered a speech via video link to the European Parliament. "Do prove that you are with us," he implored through an interpreter, who seemed to choke back tears while translating the president's words. "Do prove that you will not let us go. Do prove that you are indeed Europeans. And then life will win over death, and light will win over darkness." As one observer noted, it was as if Charlie Chaplin had morphed into Winston Churchill. Zelensky now spends his days underground, in bunkers and basements, emerging every now and then to raise the nation's spirits, often on social media. In one video message, he shares a meal with a few of his troops, bread with salami, sprouts, and instant coffee. The people who surround him are mostly old friends, the ones who followed him through the world of show business into the presidency and now to war. "No one's here by accident," his chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, wrote to me from the bunker on the seventh day of the invasion. Born in 1978, the future president grew up in a working-class Jewish family in the city of Kryvyi Rih, K-R-Y-V-Y-I space R-I-H, Crooked Horn, in the shadow of Ukraine's biggest steel mill. Like many in that part of the country, his parents spoke Russian at home. Like nearly all Jews in Ukraine, the family had suffered tremendously during World War II. Zelensky's grandfather, who commanded an artillery platoon in the Red Army, lost his father and three of his brothers in the Holocaust. After the Soviet Union fell apart in 1991, Zelensky's hometown became what he called a city of bandits, its economy in steep decline. To stay off the streets, he joined a sketch comedy troupe at 17, performing with his friends around Ukraine and later in Russia. The troupe went on to form a production company called Kvartal 95, District 95, after the neighborhood where they grew up. "It was a rough place, the kind that makes you desperate to escape," says Vadim Perevrez, Zelensky's old friend and business partner. "That was our main motivation." The offices of Kvartal 95 now occupy the top three floors of a high-rise near the center of Kyiv, with panoramic views over the city. Its walls are covered in posters for the movies they produced, mostly romantic comedies, with the future president in starring roles. Zelensky also lent his raspy voice to the animated bear in the Ukrainian version of Paddington. He worked on the Ukrainian version of Dancing with the Stars, both as a contestant, he won, and a producer. His biggest hit was a sitcom called Servant of the People, which first aired in 2015. The show was based on a wacky premise. A high school history teacher, played by Zelensky, uncorks an epic rant against corruption, which one of his students films and posts on YouTube. The clip goes viral on the eve of an election, prompting voters to install the teacher as the nation's president in a rebuke to the amoral elites. The show was a sensation in both Russia and Ukraine, and in 2019 it became Zelensky's springboard into politics. In a video posted on YouTube that New Year's Eve, he stood next to a Christmas tree and announced his intention to run for Ukraine's highest office. Voters flocked to his campaign, which was hardly traditional. Zelensky did not take part in debates or publish an electoral platform. Instead, he continued touring with his comedy show, a mix of vaudeville and political satire that was not always in the best of taste. One sketch had Zelensky pretend to play a Jewish folk song on the piano with his penis. When the act premiered in Kyiv during the presidential race, the city's biggest concert hall was filled to capacity, despite ticket prices that ran about as high as the average Ukrainian monthly pension. Members of the troupe partied backstage, wondering what cabinet positions they might get if Zelensky won. "I think I'd make a pretty good defense minister," said one comedian, Alexander Pikolov, after pouring me a shot of whiskey in a plastic cup. In his dressing room after the show, Zelensky had little interest in discussing politics or foreign affairs. The closest he came was this promise. We will figure it out. His production company had just wrapped the third season of Servant of the People, in which Zelensky's character saves Ukraine from ruin. It appeared on Netflix a few days before the election, giving voters enough time to binge the season before heading to the polls. "There is no way the others can compete with that," Zelensky told me with a smile, in his dressing room. He was right. Nearly three-quarters of the electorate cast their ballots for him in the final round of voting. His campaign swept virtually every region of the country, including those that tend to lean toward Russia. That May, Zelensky's new political party, which he had named after his sitcom, took a majority in parliament, becoming the first in Ukraine's history to control both the legislature and executive branch. Zelensky's first priority as president was to bring peace with Russia, but he faced an obstacle in Ukraine's most important ally. 2 months into his tenure, the U.S. froze aid to Ukraine worth nearly $400 million, most of it meant to shore up the nation's military. U.S. President Donald Trump wanted the Ukrainians to legitimize his claims of corruption against Joe Biden, and he was using the military aid as leverage. In a phone call in July 2019, Trump asked Zelensky to do us a favor by announcing investigations into those bogus claims. The blackmail attempt, which led to Trump's first impeachment in the House of Representatives, dented Zelensky's faith in Ukraine's foreign partners. "I don't trust anyone at all," he said when we met in his office that December. A few days later, he was due to meet Putin for the first round of peace negotiations. His expectations were low, but he was intent on doing whatever it took to avoid a broader war. "The eastern regions Russia occupied in 2014, he said, "were not worth the lives of Ukrainian soldiers. I cannot send them there," he told me. "How? How many of them will die? Hundreds of thousands, and then an all-out war will start, an all-out war in Ukraine, and then across Europe." The talks with Putin went nowhere. Russia refused to cede control of the breakaway regions in East Ukraine, and the government in Kyiv refused to grant those regions the autonomy Moscow demanded. Soon the COVID-19 pandemic was raging, and Zelensky could not secure vaccine supplies from his allies in the West, nor would he accept an offer from Putin to provide Ukraine with Russian-made vaccines, which Kyiv saw as a weapon in Moscow's information war. Many voters felt differently. By the end of 2020, public support for Zelensky dropped as low as 20% in some surveys, down from over 70% a year earlier. The Ukrainian government then turned its focus to political skirmishes, going after pro-Russian politicians and other domestic opponents. The first big target of the crackdown was Putin's close friend, Viktor Medvedchuk, who chairs the biggest opposition party in the Ukrainian parliament. The state seized the assets of Medvedchuk's family and later placed him under house arrest. Even some of Zelensky's closest allies were dismayed at the decision. It certainly raises questions about the rule of law. Dmytro Razumkov, who had led Zelensky's presidential campaign, told me in October, hours before he was ousted as Speaker of the Parliament. Putin was furious over the crackdown against his friend Medvedchuk, calling it an obvious purge of the political field. He responded by sending thousands of Russian troops to the border for a series of large-scale exercises that went on for most of 2021. Shelling and sniper fire increased along the front lines. The U.S. began to warn of a rapid escalation, even an invasion. Through it all, Zelensky tried to project a sense of calm. On our visit to the front lines in early April, he spent nearly an hour talking to the troops inside a system of trenches they had nicknamed Vietnam, a nod to the mud and morass of a war they'd seen in the movies. General Ruslan Komchak, Then the top commander of Ukraine's armed forces took the president to the spot where three of his soldiers had been killed in an ambush 2 weeks earlier. There was no tactical reason to attack that post, Komchak said. They just shot those boys in cold blood. To my surprise, Zelensky did not promise to avenge them. Instead, he questioned the wisdom of sacrificing soldiers in defense of these muddy dugouts. Ukraine had seized that bit of ground in a violent push in 2018, the year before Zelensky was elected. For some, that meant we were the tough guys, he told me before we headed back toward armored cars. For others, it meant their sons would not be coming home. The president had no intention of making such trades again. The lives of his soldiers, he said, were more valuable to him than any scraps of contested terrain. His foil in the Kremlin clearly disagreed. By early winter, numbers of Russian troops on Ukraine's borders topped 70,000. Around Halloween, the warnings from the U.S. government began to grow more dire. At meetings in Kyiv and Washington, U.S. intelligence officials and diplomats tried to convince Zelensky's team a Russian invasion was imminent. They put the chances at 80%, says one foreign policy advisor to Zelensky, who received these briefings last fall. The Americans backed up their estimates, the advisor says, with satellite imagery of Russian hardware arrayed at the border, as well as intercepted communications that suggested Russia was preparing to invade. But Zelensky and his inner circle did not believe an invasion was at hand. Ukrainian border guards told him the chances of a full-scale attack were not much higher than they had been since the war started in 2014. We're talking about a black swan event, says Yulia Mendel, a communications advisor to Zelensky. Nobody could believe it was going to happen. In the early morning of February 24, both Putin and Zelensky appeared on TV in their respective countries to deliver their final speeches before the invasion commenced. The contrast between them could not have been starker. Putin's address dripped with menace, and his claims against Ukraine were detached from reality. He said he had ordered a special military operation aimed at the demilitarization and denazification of the entire country. It was a pledge, in effect, to oust the government of a sovereign nation and destroy the armed forces of Russia's largest neighbor to the west. Putin also issued a chilling threat to any outside forces that might come to Ukraine's defense. It will lead to consequences of the sort that you have not faced ever in your history. In his own address, Zelensky chose to speak directly to the Russian people. He told them he'd tried to reach Putin that day in a final effort to avert the invasion, but the Kremlin had ignored him. Then he tried to counteract the propaganda coming from Russian state TV. You are told that these flames will bring freedom to Ukraine. But the people of Ukraine are already free, he said. In attacking us, you will see our faces, not our backs. The Russian assault began that morning with a barrage of rockets lobbed at cities across Ukraine. Troops poured over the border from multiple directions, making a push toward Kyiv from the north in an attempt to overrun the capital. Zelensky holed up in the presidential headquarters with his team of close advisers. His chief of staff, Yermak, remembers that as a moment of clarity. When you realize that, despite all your efforts, the scariest thing of all has happened, then everything becomes extremely sharp and clear, he wrote to me. We're here, they're there. They attacked us. We're defending. Truth is on our side. It gave Ukraine a clear advantage in the information war, where Zelensky's stagecraft turned into a powerful weapon. As Russia spread lies about neo-Nazis using children in Ukraine as human shields, Zelensky countered with a barrage of posts on social media, letting his people hear the earnest, grainy voice they'd come to know from his movies. He seemed to be near them, and he was. Zelensky had refused an offer from the U.S. to evacuate him to safer ground. I need ammunition, he told the Americans, not a ride. The president did not even retreat from the government quarter in Kyiv center, nor did he wear a bulletproof vest. Photos and videos showed him in a T-shirt as he led his besieged nation from some of the same familiar rooms with their indigo carpets and heavy chandeliers where I had met him and his staff at the start of his tenure. Only now the floors were heaped with sandbags and soldiers stood around, forming a weak defense against the Russian bombs that fell nearby. Images of devastation reached Zelensky's team from across the country. Dozens of fatalities, including children, as artillery pounded residential neighborhoods, a missile striking the TV tower in Kyiv, another one landing on the central square of Kharkiv in the east. Yet for every report of a Russian barrage, there was news of Ukrainians standing their ground, destroying columns of armored Russian vehicles, capturing tanks and prisoners of war. It soon became clear to military experts Putin had misjudged both the will and the ability of Ukrainians to resist. U.S. intelligence assesses that morale is sagging around the Russian soldiers on the ground, according to a senior U.S. defense official. On the fourth day of the invasion, Zelensky sent a few of his comrades to an initial round of peace talks with Putin's men. I'm ending this article. It is slightly abridged. For Zelensky, that moment may have come February 25, the second night of the invasion. There's no faking that kind of courage. He walked outside his office into winter air, surrounded by his closest aides, and filmed a simple message on his phone. "We're all here." Simon Schuster reported with additional reporting by Alejandro de la Garza, W.J. Hennigan, Nick Popley, and Simone Shaw. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.